From Sacramento, the Bishop's Radio Hour with Bob Dunning. Focusing on today's issues in the context of gospel values. Now, here's Bob Dunning on Relevant Radio.
That's me. Welcome to you on this beautiful day the Lord has made. Appreciate you all being with us on the Bishop's Hour. So much happening. We should remind you, as our colleges and universities are and our schools are opening in one form or another, some in person, some in, with a hybrid, some distance learning only, should remind you that our great Newman Centers at UC Davis, Sacramento State, Chico State are up and running, and the Newman Center at Davis, they've adapted their weekly programming to be a fusion of in-person and virtual activities. On Mondays, they host game nights versus Zoom at 7 o'clock. On Wednesday evenings, they have socially distanced picnics at the local Davis Farmers Market. Their 40 student volunteers are also working on preparing the upcoming year that will be full of opportunities for new and returning students of UC Davis, weekly masses, retreats, fellowships, Newman Nights, solidarity and justice work, and much more are on the horizon. A lot planned for the 2021 school year. And you can check with Sacramento State Newman Center, Chico State Newman Center, and, of course, UC Davis Newman Center. UC Davis, the contact is Vince Nims. Vince is his email is vnims, N-I-M-S, vnims, M as in Mary, vnims at scd.org. And it's just great to have our Newman Centers on our three major college campuses here in the Diocese of Sacramento. We're just pleased and honored and excited to have Father Steve Avella join us, a professor of history at Marquette University, but somebody who's so well-versed in the Diocese of Sacramento and all the great history here. Father, good day to you. Thanks so much for taking the time to be with us.
Bob, this is an unexpected summer delight. I always miss talking to you, but... thanks for having me on.
Oh, thank you. So much happening. I know. I think the last time we talked on the radio was maybe after the death of Bishop Quinn.
Yes. Yeah. I got a chance to rehash my love and affection and understanding of what I think will be his great place in diocesan history. But I miss him dearly. Usually, whenever I got here, one of the first things I did was to go over and see him at Mercy McMahon and. Mm-hmm. What a confession, and I sure do miss him.
Yeah, I remember I used to do a nightly talk show on KFBK, not a religious show, just a you know, general talk. One night announced that our next guest was going to be Bishop Quinn, and he was going to be on in about 15 minutes, and immediately every single phone line was jammed. Immediately, before he was even on the air.
Oh, what a guy.
Yeah, he was, and I remember years ago in my role as a newspaper columnist, had written a column about, I'd gotten some solicitation from cemeteries, not from Catholic cemeteries, but from a cemetery about pre-planning, and I had written kind of a tongue-in-cheek thing. I'm 30 years old. Why are you sending me this kind of thing, you know? And I get this note from Bishop Quinn, who I'd never met. This is before email, almost before the phone was invented. I get this note from him saying, "Thank you for tackling this grave issue." That's all it said.
That was one of his blessings was, he never took himself really seriously. I mean, he was a true servant bishop and, would help people when they're, but, he avoided anything that kind of blew up his significance as a bishop. And I remember when he was the oldest bishop in the United States.
Right.
And the person who had been ahead of him for a long time was Raymond Hunthausen of Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
And when Hunthausen died, he called me and said, "Well, now I made it. I'm the oldest. You owe me proper deference, Avella."
Well, I was on an anniversary of the Bishop's Hour, I can't remember which one, a couple of years ago, and we had decided we were going to get Bishop Wiegand, Bishop Soto, of course, Bishop Cotta, and at the time, I believe Bishop Garcia was still alive, and we were going to get Bishop Quinn. And somebody said, well, you better hurry up with Bishop Quinn. He's fading fast. You know, and so we Gabe, our producer, calls him, and Gabe Sorensen, and he says, can we get you for five, 10 minutes? You know, oh, yeah, sure, fine. And he wanted to do it by phone, and we go the whole hour. Go the whole hour.
No, he was. I would go in just to spend maybe 4 or 5 minutes with him. I didn't get out till a nurse came with his lunch or something.
Yeah,
he was talking, and it was fine.
I remember him saying that it was when he was in hospice. It was the last time we had talked to him, and he said, "I've been in hospice so long, people have stopped praying for me. They don't believe it."
Yeah. Oh, what a giant. What a saint really, we were blessed to have here.
Bob. Really, really was. So you grew up in the Sacramento area?
I did, yeah. My family moved out here in the early 50s. My dad worked in the field, the emerging field of electronics, first in Southern California, and then we moved here to Sacramento. And my dad worked at McClellan Field for most of his working career in a few places elsewhere in between, but he spent most of his time at McClellan working on communications with the Air Force. He was a civilian employee.
So was he like a DOD employee?
Yeah. Well, the Department of Defense was his ultimate employer, and we lived on Auburn Boulevard way back in the day when things were a little more tame.
When it was a two-lane road?
We moved to North Highlands when it was just a burgeoning suburb. Mm-hmm. We lived in an apartment there. And then my parents' first home was in North Highlands. We were among the founding members of St. Lawrence.
Oh, St. Lawrence, sure.
Out there, Father Virgilio, or later Monsignor Virgilio Gabrielli, was our pastor. And he used to eat dinner at our house on Sunday. And as I found out later, we were one of about four places he stopped for dinner on Sunday. But he was a delightful gem of a man. And then the final move was out to Orangevale, where my mom still lives.
Mm-hmm.
And there we went. We were the parishioners at St. John the Baptist in Folsom. There was no church in Orangevale. And then when Divine Savior opened up, first in the bingo hall, and then they had a kind of a tent, and then the church. My parents were there. They contributed to it, and then at the end there, I remember my dad saying, "I'm not contributing to any more new churches. We're staying here, at Divine Savior." So, my growing up memories were all here. I didn't go to Catholic school. I did because there were just none around at that time, and I went to public school, the San Juan Unified School District,
right,
where I got a really good education for the most part, a really good, wonderful teachers.
Was that San Juan High School?
And when high school came, that's when I went back into the Catholic system. I went to St. Pius X Seminary.
Oh, already, sure.
Which had, 170 or something guys at that time. It was really quite a place. Four very formative and very challenging, and I would say very happy years in the minor seminary with guys ahead of me were guys like James Kidder.
Yes, from Woodland.
And John Bull.
Yes.
Joseph Ternullo, Jim Sheets, the guys who were priests of the diocese, all retired now. And then, Michael Barber, the Bishop of Oakland.
Right.
Years behind me. He was a freshman. I was a senior. I was the head sacristan that year. And Michael was on my team. We were, running around lighting candles, cleaning the chapel, that sort of stuff. Yeah, so there's the whole cadre of people who went to St. Pius are kind of...
Boy, those are all familiar names to me, having grown up here as well. So did your vocation come very early in life? Did you always know you were going to become a priest?
I can tell you the exact time and spot.
Wow.
It was, I was 7 years old. It was Mother's Day. I had just made my first communion maybe a week or two before, and the grotto at St. Lawrence Parish was just being dedicated. And it had rained outside, I remember, and they had built this. Well, it's still there. I see that the priests are still using it now for outdoor masses. My dad had helped build that, go down to the American River and filch stones. I don't know if that was legal in those days, but they got all those stones, and they made this. And that day, I remember, I was sitting on a bench in a wool suit, of all things, and I had sat in a pile of puddle of water, so I remember that part of it. But in to dedicate the shrine came future Archbishop Joseph McGuckin. At his side, I saw later in a picture, was Monsignor Thomas Kirby. And when they went past me, I was so overawed by their vestments and by how imposing they looked. I said, "Yeah, I want to be a priest." Hmm. I remember it as vividly as I'm talking to you now.
Wow.
Years later, I went there. I lived at St. Lawrence with Father Jerry Ryle. He gave me bed and board while I was on one of my sabbaticals. And then Jerry was transferred, and I managed the parish for a few happy months. They were just wonderful people. And I used my pastoral authority to plant a tree on that spot, I remember. Mm. The tree is still there. That's my vocation.
Wow. Area. What kind of tree?
I don't know. It's got leaves and the branches and a trunk.
I'll have to take an arborist out there and have him identify it.
Yeah, it's Steve Avella's vocation tree.
That's great.
You know, I hope people don't think that that's, too narcissistic. But people ask me the moment, and I, as sure as God made little green apples, I remember that almost going into me. I want to be a priest, and I never, ever let that go.
Wow.
Never. From 7 years old now, I'm nearly 70.
Whoa, what a wonderful story.
Strange ways with strange people like me.
Boy, that's a great story. I love that story.
Yeah.
So were you incarnated in the Diocese of Sacramento?
No. When we went to St. Pius, we were all considered students for Sacramento. There were some guys there from Reno. And then even places like Santa Rosa and Stockton, a few guys, but most of us were Sacramento. During the high school years there, I was so impressed and so bowled over by the Salvatorian priest who taught us that I decided I wanted to be a teaching priest, especially in social studies, history, that sort of stuff. They have marvelous teachers, and so I joined them. In 1969, when I graduated high school, I entered the Salvatorian community. We parted ways in 1989, not bitterly. We were still very good friends. I love all those guys dearly. But I became a priest of the Archdiocese of Milwaukee, where I had basically done all of my professional work. My first years as a priest were out there, in graduate school, and my early careers in both high school and collegiate teaching were out there, and so
was that all at Marquette?
I taught several places before Marquette. I taught at St. Francis de Sales Seminary, where I still live. That's where I'm going back when I return for the semester. I taught at Cardinal Church University, now it's called. It was a small liberal arts college. Very happy there, wonderful place. And then the call came to Marquette definitively in 1991. I had taught there as an adjunct in 1989, 1990, and they thought I was a good guy. So from 91 to the present, I have been an employee of Marquette University and, have begun the process of making my migration back here. When I retire, which isn't all that far in the distance, I'm going to come back here permanently. I'll live here. My mom is still alive. My siblings are all out here, and I have many, many, many friends out here that I've made over the years going back and forth and helping the parishes and saying mass in different places. And then, of course, investing myself in studying the history and the culture
sure.
of Sacramento, of the Diocese of Sacramento, of the West Coast. I've written histories of Reno, the Reno Diocese. I'm a Westerner, even though I'm in temporary exile in the Midwest.
You know,
I don't want to trash that because the people of the Archdiocese of Milwaukee, the bishops and fellow priests, they've been wonderful. It's a good place. I mean, everybody has their ups and downs, but it's been mostly up for me.
Wow. Well, home is where the heart is, that's for sure.
Yes, indeed.
We will welcome you back with open arms. Do you have any Al McGuire stories?
No, he was long gone by the time I got there. But he's a legend, and his ghost inhabits the campus there, and the hope springs bright every basketball season.
Yes.
So, you know, things are not going so well now. They put up a practice facility in which we occasionally hold commencements for the College of Arts and Sciences, and it's called the Al. His statue dominates the place there. And,
yeah.
But that's the Al. But oh yeah, there is many an aging Marquette alum who sighs heavily. Oh, wish we had Al McGuire back.
Oh yeah. Yeah, especially when another Catholic institution like a Villanova or Gonzaga is getting all the attention.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, yeah, you know, one curiosity I've had about Wisconsin, and I could have my numbers wrong, but why is it that Green Bay is so heavily Catholic?
Well, immigration patterns. Mm-hmm. A lot of Catholic groups came there, for example, from the Netherlands. There's a significantly... The Dutch are not known, you know, as one of the premier Catholic mm-hmm. cohorts of Europe, but a lot of Dutch Catholic people moved into that area. Belgians, people from northern Europe, Germans, Poles, up in and around that area. Of course, is some industry. Green Bay is along the lake there, and the lake is really kind of the generator of population and industry, and they're clearinghouses for what happens out in the country. But Green Bay has industry, it has academic institutions, and it has it has a culture unto itself. But the Catholic ethnic groups that you would want to look at would be German, Irish, Dutch, Belgian. Those would be among the largest.
Mm-hmm.
There would also be Bohemians, you know, people who are from Czech people,
right.
And even some Slovaks. But those groups came in significant numbers to work in local industry, either manufacturing or logging a little mm-hmm. further out to the west. Those were big economic generators, and Green Bay was the beneficiary of that.
Very interesting. Yeah, I remember reading some of the history of Butte, Montana, and it was all the Irish miners.
Oh, gosh, you know. Those guys were wealthy.
Yeah.
That's the most recent book I'm working on is Catholic Life in the 20th Century West, and I've been spending a little time reading about Butte and those miners and
yeah.
and the beauty of the churches. I think I've been in the church in Butte.
Yes.
And it is a gem. It is just a gem. And they had a lot of money to do that. Unfortunately, they're in Butte. The mine owners wanted to make the men work on Sundays, and this got the local bishops kind of unhappy. As a matter of fact, wherever there were mining communities, I suspect it happened here, even in California, that the work demands of the mines
right.
keep guys away from mass, and the bishops would register a complaint, and then the people who owned the mines said, "Well, look here. You mind your manners, you're not going to get any money," and it could become sort of unpleasant. And Butte was one of the places where that happened, that there was kind of a standoff between the mine owners and the local Catholic establishment.
Yeah, and they still have that huge, I don't know if you've been to Butte, the Berkeley Pit there.
Yes.
Which
yes,
is unbelievable to look at. It's mind-boggling.
And you think of all that came out of there.
Oh, yeah, for years and years and years.
Wire America.
Yeah. Well, you know, one day my wife, who's from Billings, she and I were driving along shortly after we got married. We were driving along, I think it's I-90, heading through Montana. And I said to her, I just saw the Blessed Mother. And she's like, uh-oh. Do we need to pull off the road here? And I said, no. Around that last bend we came around, I saw her up on a mountain. And she's going, give me a break. You know, no way. I know you're more religious than I am. And we come around another bend. I pull off, and I say, there. And we look up, and there in all her glory is the Blessed Mother on a hill overlooking Butte, Montana. And so we pull into Butte, and we go to the little railroad car, which was serving as the Chamber of Commerce. And we walked in, and they've got all these postcards with the Blessed Mother on them on the hill. And this is called Our Lady of the Rockies. And they have this whole history of it was one man who was not even Catholic who came up with this idea because to honor all the Catholics in this town, and he was a sculptor or a metal worker or something, and I believe it's like 90 feet tall, and worked on it and raised money and did all of this, and the whole town got involved. The U.S. Air Force provided helicopters to hoist it, to you know, take it all the way to the top of the mountain. And it's unbelievable. I managed to interview somebody from up there about it, and it's there it is, you know, a merger of church and state. The whole town got behind Our Lady of the Rockies, and it's still there.
Those lovely public monuments are I was driving once south, and I went through the panhandle of Texas.
Mm-hmm.
I came upon a place, I believe it was in the panhandle of Texas, where it was a huge, huge cross. And around it were these exquisitely sculpted bronze statues of the Stations of the Cross. I thought, like, I'm a little nowhere. Where is this? And I thought, wow, this is fantastic. Who did this? And every one of those stories is fascinating, Bob. Every one of those public expressions, those expressions of faith that occupy public space, that are visible, you know, says something about the people, the culture at the time.
Yep.
It's a window into faith, local faith, and it's a window into, you know, how we use the environment to advance the cause of the gospel.
Indeed, you know, and it makes your heart beat stronger, I now have this enormous fondness for Butte, Montana.
It's a beautiful. All I remember of it is that church I walked in.
Yeah.
Blown away. This church could be in Europe. You know, this is how exquisitely beautiful this was. And these rough mining frontiers. I mean, these were, you know, rough and tumble places, at least at the outset. But Catholic miners were determined to leave their mark.
Indeed. Yeah, in wonderful. In fact, speaking of Irish Catholic miners, wasn't Bishop Minogue of that ilk?
Yes. He, you know, our cathedral, and his work in Virginia City that preceded it would be a reflection of, you know, the marriage of mining wealth with Catholic beauty and Catholic size, grandiosity. You know, there was very much part of how he understood the church had to function in this emerging part of the world. And again, using the wealth generated from the earth, you know, from the precious metals to precious ores and industrial materials that were taken from, I mean, all this generated a lot of money because it fed this enormous and growing industrial complex that we had here in the United States, not to mention the growing needs of our economy for, you know, manageable currency. But we needed lots of gold. We needed lots of silver to be able to accommodate the purchasing of goods and, you know, the exchanges of the market. We had to have some sort of a medium. And the West provided it. provided copper. I mean, we started to wire our houses for electricity. Where was all this copper going to come from for the wiring? And we produced some of it. We got imported a lot of it from Chile and other parts of the world that created these international supply chains, which still define our business realities. But yeah, that Minogue. The more I think about him, you know, that Cathedral of ours, Bob, was, and I don't want this to sound shocking, this wasn't the desire of the people of Sacramento.
Mm-hmm.
They had a church on 7th and K. It was kind of ramshackle and falling down. I see they have renamed Old St. Rose Square for another person at 7th and K.
Right.
They had that church, and they had built that church, and it had, you know, it wasn't in the best shape. But then Minogue starts to build this cathedral, and he could not get ordinary Sacramentans that would be Sacramentans employed by the rail yards or by the canneries or, you know, the service industries, the things that where people would make a modest income here. There wasn't a lot of big wealth here. So where the money came from was from his very wealthy friends that he had met in Virginia City, and whom he had helped.
Hmm.
You know, it's no good deed goes unpunished or unrewarded. And Minogue had helped two of the people who gave significant sums for the construction of the cathedral. And he built big, because in those days, that period of time in U.S. history we call the Gilded Age, there were many people who made lots and lots of money, and their impulse were to build these huge mansions, all of the summer homes in Newport, Rhode Island,
right.
All of the big mansions on Fifth Avenue. San Francisco had its own set of, you know, its own aristocracy. These were all people with mineral wealth, and so Minogue's decision to build that huge cathedral, which was far larger than the actual Catholic needs of Sacramento at that time, the number of Catholics would grow. All of this, you know, points to, you know, not only a refocus on Minogue's role, which is significant, pivotal. He's the guy who did the good pastor work. He's the guy who planned and pushed all this through. But also on these benefactors, a couple of them are women, Catholic women. This is Teresa Fair and her daughters, Tessie and Bertie. Minogue had been great friends to them. And Mrs. Fair built the house that used to sit, you know, off toward, you know, from the rear of the cathedral towards 12th Street, where Ella's restaurant is now, and the diocesan. That was a house that Mrs. Fair had bought. Windows in the cathedral, Mrs. Fair's daughters had put in. John W. McKay, who was another major benefactor, wasn't really a practicing Catholic, but he had met his wife, a woman by the name of Marie Bryant Hungerford. She had been the wife of a doctor in Virginia City who was a particularly brutal man. He had abused her, he abused their children. He was not a very nice man. And he died, leaving poor Marie Louise, her name, widowed. Minogue helped her. Minogue pulled us, got the kid buried, took her under, got her a job working in doing needlework and things like that, and then introduced her, or it was part of the introduction of her to John W. McKay, who was one of the great silver barons.
Hmm.
So he married the two of them. He put the two together. McKay respected Minogue, helped him out financially, and those acts of generosity, you know, that were extended to women, Marie Louise, Teresa Fair, provided much of the capital, at least for the initial building of the cathedral, and permitted Sacramentans to enjoy it, even though, you know, if it were up to them to pay for it, they couldn't have done it. They couldn't have put up the money for that magnificent building. And we're the beneficiaries of it today.
Wow. Speaking of beautiful churches, the church in Virginia City is quite striking.
Magnificent. And it burned several, and it came back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was reminded of that church in Virginia City. It's still a fun place to visit. They've got a great museum. If your listeners, if you can get out, know, be careful. You know, wear masks, do what you need to do. But if you ever get a chance to get a jaunt to see that place, it's got a great little museum and lots of interesting things. I was reminded of it. I went recently to a Jesuit ordination at St. Ignatius Parish.
Mm-hmm.
And St. Ignatius has got rather funky windows, and modern abstract sort of windows that circle the church. And they're very bright, very colorful. And they were done by a man, a priest, and a sort of a monk who had earlier been in charge of St. Mary of the Mountains Church in Virginia City. He had a little monastic community with him, and he himself was an artist. And what this guy did was he began to kind of rip out all the things Minogue had put into the church. It was really a very tragic moment in the history of the church, and people were outraged that he was taking down crucifixes and altar rails, and he went a bit too far in his zeal in trying to simplify the church, or so he thought, that he pulled out props for the walls of the church. I know this from the fellow who succeeded him, a wonderful priest of the Diocese of Reno by the name of Cesar Caviglia. He just died a few years ago. Cesar told me, he said, I had to go in there after him, and we had to reinforce the walls. The building was going to collapse. Well, again, this same fellow who had done this, was asked to leave, and then he got jobs, and among his remnant there is are those windows at St. Ignatius Church in Sacramento.
Wow. Wow. We're talking with Father Steve Avella about the great great history of everywhere, of the West as well. You know, I've always been interested in high school mascots and college mascots, and there's a lot of history. You know, like I believe Virginia City, when they still had a high school, they were the Muckers.
No kidding.
And Tillamook, Oregon, the high school is the Cheesemakers.
That makes sense.
Yeah, it makes sense.
I've visited that factory. That's kind of a cool place.
Yeah, the Montana Tech, which is in Butte, or the Ore Diggers. You could learn a lot from mascots.
In Milwaukee, one of our high schools is named after Pius the 11th,
mm-hmm.
And Pi High XI, they call it. The team's name are the Popes. And the women's team are, get this, the Lady Popes.
Oh, wow. it's so common now. You know, you've got the traditional mascot, and then with the rise of women's sports, it's usually the lady whatever, And that's a good one.
Lady Popes.
Has the Vatican weighed in on that?
The guy who built the high school was a Palatine priest, and he was a kind of a wheeler dealer for money, and so he named it for Pius the 11th, who was the reigning pope, and sent him a telegram saying, Holy Father, we've named a high school after you, and so on, and we're so pleased that you, and so on, hoping that Pius the 11th would open up the Vatican treasuries and send him, 100,000 lira or whatever, and all he got back was a papal blessing. That reminded me of a variation on the old T-shirt. You know, I wanted to build a new high school. All I got was this papal blessing or something.
Oh, that's funny. Of course, I grew up with Pius the 12th.
Okay.
And that's all I knew. It was like Eisenhower was president. I figured he was president for life, and mm-hmm. Pius the 12th was. I didn't realize we'd have another president or another pope. I just, that was who the pope was Pius the 12th.
I remember him. I was born in 51, so I remember, of course, I remember that tall, stately figure with the round glasses, his arms outstretched. I've seen many pictures, blessing, and then when welcoming the American troops into Rome, and he was the first future pope to come to America. He made a very famous trip He blessed the Bay Bridge.
Really?
As a cardinal. He came out here in the 1930s, accompanied by an up-and-coming young auxiliary bishop named Francis Spellman. And, and he traveled all around the country. One of the places that he stopped was in the Southwest, where the Navajos live.
Mm-hmm.
It would be northwestern New Mexico and then northeastern Arizona. And
right.
Was so taken by what he saw there that, you know, he felt they weren't getting adequate religious care. And so, one of the things that led to the creation of the Diocese of Gallup.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the few dioceses that spans two states.
Two states,
because
yeah.
Gallup has to go from New Mexico to Arizona and back again, was because of what he saw there in the 1930s.
Wow.
It was quite a trip. And then, but he wasn't the first Roman official to come to the United States and inspect things, but the first one who came and later became a pope. The only other person I remember doing that with any depth was Cardinal Montini came. He received an honorary degree at Notre Dame.
Mm-hmm.
And then this young Polish guy named Wojtyła came in 76 to the Eucharistic Congress, and he traveled the Midwest a good bit, finding local colonies of Polish Catholics. And bingo, presto, who steps out onto the balcony in October of 1978.
Wow. Father, one of the reasons I think the hook we had to get you on the air today was the demise, if you will, of the McClatchy Empire, which started right here in Sacramento.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about and you've written a book.
I came out in 2016.
Charles K. McClatchy and the Golden Era of American Journalism.
That was my book. University of Missouri Press. Where do you want me to begin? The McClatchys, let me say a few things about the McClatchys that are, I think, significant and perhaps of more specific interest to your audience here. One, they have been part of Sacramento almost from the outset. James McClatchy, the father, the granddaddy of the family, came to the West from Northern Ireland to mine, and like many miners, people who had no experience with this, gave it up after a while, and then becomes involved in journalism, local politics, and then finally, you know, he begins to kind of gradually take over the Sacramento Bee, leaving, when he died, at least one other partner, and then it was turned over to his sons, Charles Kay and Valentine McClatchy, who ran the paper and then handed it on to their heirs. The McClatchys were Catholic. James wasn't. James was in the Episcopal Church. And at least that's where he was buried from. But his wife, Charlotte McCormack Feeney, she was a widow. He married her. She was a very devout Catholic. And he got his marriage blessed at St. Rose Church in St. Kay. And she practiced her faith very diligently. She was very interested in the education of her children. Her daughters went to St. Joseph's Academy. They studied there under the Sisters of Mercy. The two sons, Valentine and C.K., both went to Santa Clara.
Hmm.
And there they in Santa Clara in those days was more like a seminary. It was,
right.
You know, you lived in there, you lived under a kind of a discipline. Valentine did very well. C.K. hated it. And it dropped out. He never finished his degree. C.K., who becomes kind of the dominant figure, marries the daughter of an Irish immigrant from Philadelphia, a woman by the name of Ella Kelly. Ella Kelly also was a graduate of St. Joseph's Academy, and she became a teacher out of that. In those days, St. Joseph's Academy could hand out a teaching credential, we would call it today, And she was very devoutly religious and would be until the end of her life. C.K. and she also got married at Old St. Rose, and the priest who married them was the pastor then, Father Thomas Grace, who became Bishop Thomas Grace of the Diocese of Sacramento. This family had several children. They had a son named Carlos. They had a daughter named Emily. And then they also had Eleanor, who was born in 1895. When Eleanor was baptized, her godfather was, and the man who baptized her, was Thomas Grace. Mm. Eleanor's full name was Eleanor Grace McClatchy. Her middle name was after the bishop. That was how much the family held him in esteem. Other priests came and went in their family. Long and short of it was, C.K. really kind of walked away from the church. He was a non-practicing Catholic. He would take Ella to Mass and then go work in his office and pick her up after Mass. She went to the cathedral. His religion was more kind of a humanitarianism. He had read a lot of Charles Dickens. He had read a lot of you know, people who inspired him to be a moral and ethical person, but his religious beliefs were not as well-defined or sharp as perhaps his Jesuit teachers had tried to give him at Santa Clara. Ella was the devout Catholic. She raised the children Catholic, although only of all of them, of their children, only, I think, Eleanor remotely practiced the religion. She was, I believe she was buried from the cathedral. I think that was where her funeral mass was. And she was very generous to the Catholic Church in her benefactions. How does this all affect the position of the sacramental bee? Because C.K. and his brother Valentine were really the voice of the bee. There was no such thing as an editorial board. The stockholders weren't breathing down their neck for this, that, or the other. So what was, how did the bee regard the Catholic faith? Well, in one sense, with respect and reverence, C.K. understood the church. He enjoyed the company of priests and bishops, especially Bishop Grace, whom he loved very dearly. There was an English expatriate cleric here by the name of Thomas John Capel. He's buried in St. Joseph's Cemetery. Monsignor Capel was sort of a rake, who had come to the United States after some very scandalous things in England. He'd kind of set out in exile in near Galt for a while, and then Bishop Grace brought him back into the fold, and he was a great preacher, very much loved when he died in 1911. And C.K. loved his company, too. He was a very literate, articulate man. C.K. met two popes. He met Pius X. And he met Pius XI.
Wow.
Both guys, Bishop Grace had written him letters of introduction to both. That being said, C.K. had, you know, some bees in his bonnet about certain aspects of the Catholic faith. He did not, you know, he did not appreciate the kind of status of nobility that attached itself to the papal office. He often used to say, you know, that pope needs is a stovepipe hat. See, they should be more like Abraham Lincoln. Secondly, he could be very praiseworthy of clergy and the like. If a clergy person did something he didn't like, they got blasted sometimes on the front page of the paper. And the worst, he was famous for getting into verbal brawls with his opponents, and he had a number of them. The worst one, the one that had the most invective and horrible things said, and I'm talking about setting detectives on the other one side or the other and really going after each other with pamphlets and the like, was the argument between McClatchy and Peter York of San Francisco, the famous labor priest there, who was a larger-than-life figure. These two men detested each other and battled each other on the pages of their respective newspapers. C.K., of course, had the bee. York had a newspaper that was pu- published in San Francisco, but sold here in Sacramento on the steps of the cathedral called The Leader. It's a kind of an Irish nationalist paper, but he would frequently be lambasting the clergy, or McClatchy, having all kinds of, horrible cartoons about depicting McClatchy as a skunk or as a dog or something like that. And then these two guys went back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And finally, a ceasefire was called, and it was never resumed. So his reverence for the clergy had limits, and not just Catholic clergy, but Protestant clergy as well. One last point. He very much defended the church when the Ku Klux Klan rose here in Sacramento in the 1920s. It was a very large Klan outburst here in Sacramento, encouraged by some of the more, antagonistic Protestant ministers. One of the centers of it was Westminster Presbyterian Church. Thank God they're not like that at all now. They're great friends to the Catholic community. But in the 1920s, they had a minister who welcomed Klan members into the church and so on. And McClatchy just went after them, saying, "This is un-American. You can't do this. This is wrong." I mean, he really called them out. He put a fire under the seat of the local police department to go after these guys, and he ran stories about them. And he ended up becoming really one of the most outspoken foes of the Klan here in Sacramento. They never really had a chance with CK on their tail. And, of course, the Catholic Church benefited from that because the second Klan, as it's known by historians, had its laundry list of haters, but at the top of it was the Catholic Church.
Yeah, yeah.
That incarnation of the Klan. When I hear now Klan members claim to be Catholic, I think, oh my God, how could this happen?
Responsible for closing Catholic schools in the state of Oregon in the 1920s.
Absolutely, yeah. Shooting a priest as he sat on his porch because he had presided at an interracial marriage. Harassing, antagonizing Catholic churches. Catholic merchants were boycotted by Klan decree. There were a few places where the Catholics fought back. I had a student at Marquette who wrote a doctoral dissertation about places where the Klan met rather concerted Catholic opposition. One of the places they decided to pick a fight was in South Bend, Indiana, with the Notre Dame football team. They did not come out well from that. These big Irish lunkers, you're going to attack my church,
But, oh, that's great.
Yeah, yeah. So there it is. The McClatchys, and I'm sorry that their old leadership, they did a lot for Sacramento. They did a lot for the Central Valley. They stayed here. Many people who got wealthy here in Sacramento soon left. They went to San Francisco or other parts of the state. McClatchy stayed here and helped Sacramento grow, helped direct its expansion, its progress. Were they perfect? No. Did they make their mistakes? Were there blind spots in their activities? I mean, the sad thing about the CK and his brother Valentine is they were terribly racist. Terribly racist. Not just towards African Americans, but especially towards Asians. Japanese, Chinese, they it stirred up antagonism toward them, and that's a sad chapter in their history.
Especially with all the contributions of those groups to California.
Absolutely. And not only that, they preferred to have Japanese cooks and gardeners in their
homes. Yeah.
So that's the distaff side. But, Bob, that's history.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Are we, one day, well, we have C.K. McClatchy High School. Is that one day going to be an issue?
Could be. It could be. And maybe Asian Americans would take exception to that. And, they would have a case to be upset with that. That name, of course, came, it was the second high school in the city that name came from, kind of the pushing of CK's great friend, Hiram Johnson, and local people, too. But we'll see. We're, you've got this sort of thing that calls to accountability some of the decisions of the past. Is this the right person?
Where was the bee in the early days?
The bee was downtown, first on 3rd Street, then on 7th. 7th Street, the old bee building was there for many years, and then in the 50s, it moved out there to 21st and Q, which is kind of a remnant of the building. I don't think, the bee owns it anymore.
No, no.
So, that, yeah, they moved three times in the course of their experience.
I remember out of college, worked about halftime for the Bee, covering UC Davis sports, and usually you were a correspondent and you were phoning your stuff in. But one day, I forget, they were shorthanded or something, and it was one night I got called in, and actually met, I believe it was Eleanor.
Oh yeah, she would have been around.
Yeah.
Yes.
And Who would have been the male McClatchy at that time?
That would have been C.K. Junior.
Yeah, I met him, you know, and I felt like I was. It was just brief, but it was like you were meeting royalty or something, you know.
Somebody needs to do a book about Eleanor. I mean, she really was a. She's a quiet, sort of unassuming woman with a very bad stutter at one point. She went to school in New York and kind of learned how to be an equestrian, and she got into a disastrous marriage. She married an airman from Mazur Field, and they had a beautiful wedding. Bishop Kane of Sacramento did it in their backyard. I've seen pictures of it. It was a very high-class wedding, but it broke up. I mean, the marriage broke up. She never remarried. And she was a benefactor of the Catholic Church. For any of you listeners who go to St. Rose Church on Franklin Boulevard, look at those windows. Those are all donated by Eleanor and her mother in honor of Carlos McClatchy, who died very young, very tragically, in the early 1930s. In 1939, when the mama died, Ella, who had been a faithful parishioner at the cathedral, they made a major contribution to the cathedral, which was in the process of renovating. They had closed the dome, and they gave an altar. They gave a beautiful crucifix that used to be attached to the rear wall. They took it down in the most recent restoration, and they gave lots of money for other Catholic events. Grace Day Home. The Stanford Mansion. They had when the Sisters of Social Service were there and had a chapel in there. An artist from the Bee produced a series of beautiful Stations of the Cross. I often wonder what happened to them, who took them. Eleanor had a very wide understanding of art history, of drama. I mean, she's very much beyond. A driving force behind the culture of drama, music, you know, productions for the people here in music circus, for one thing. I mean, that's Eleanor's thumbprint. She wanted to be a playwright. She didn't want to be a newspaper editor. She left a lot of monuments from which we, the Catholic Church, benefited. Those windows in St. Rose are beautiful.
I'm going to have to go down there and look. I've been at St. Rose.
Look at the dedications underneath. And I believe also some of the altar decorations to the statuary and the things. I think those were also, you know, late Monsignor Kavanaugh was, I didn't know him really well, but we talked a few times about what the McClatchys had done for St. Rose. Same thing with the cathedral when they were restoring it and putting that in. I had really nothing to say, but I that crucifix, I think it was done by some Spanish artist that Eleanor had contracted. You know, well, take it down if you need to, but put it someplace where it can perhaps be reassembled someplace. I don't know. I don't know if they did that or if it's sitting in. I hope it's sitting in a warehouse somewhere.
That will be our next project to uncover that. Maybe when you move back out here, we can the two of us can go look for it.
We'll go on a ditty in one of those. We'll go down one of those shows where we're
right.
Hunting, you know.
A treasure hunt.
Treasures. Yeah.
Yeah, so, Father, it is we're flat out of time. We didn't have anywhere near enough to thank you for being so generous with your time, and thanks for just bringing us up to date on all the great history. The book of many, Charles K. McClatchy and the Golden Era of American Journalism, a must read from University of Missouri Press. I look forward to the day when our paths will cross again soon.
Thanks, Bob. Greetings to your audience. Thank you, my friends at Holy Trinity, my friends at St. Lawrence, my friends at the cathedral, at places that I've helped out, Holy Cross and Bright. These are all wonderful places of ministerial growth for me, and I love you all dearly.
Yeah, and you've got people who are very fond of you at parishes you don't even know about. So.
Yeah. They only knew me, Bob.
They only knew you. Yeah. Yeah. As I understand it, and we've only got about 30 seconds, but the Our Lady of Grace in West Sacramento was, a chapel at an air base.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a very popular thing here. They moved in a lot of these buildings from Camp Coleman. That was how, for example, Holy Family in Citrus Heights got started. That was a moved-in building, an old chapel from Camp Wallerga out there. And there's any number of buildings that began that way because there was just all these surplus buildings after the war was over. And there's tons of those. And then eventually they morphed into something else. Our Lady of Grace is a beautiful little church. They're probably growing big enough, though, that it's going to be time for a new
one. They're going to need a new one or expand it. That's right. Well, Father, we'll look forward to talking to you again soon. Stay safe and well, and just God bless your work.
Thank you, Bob. Anytime I can help, don't hesitate to ask.
Well, we sure will. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
That's Father Steve Avella, professor of history at Marquette in Milwaukee. That's going to do it for us for today. Thanks for listening. God bless. Standing.
for.